Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe, where the mission is to normalize the conversation on sexuality while providing you with a real education on sex, intimacy, and relationships. You know, the one you never got in school, from your parents, friends, or the internet. I'm your host, Susan Morgan Taylor. As a sex therapist for couples, I've empowered thousands of couples around the world to get back on the same page in intimacy using my proprietary Pleasure Keys process. Find out more about that at pleasurekeys.com. Join me here at the Sex Talk Cafe for juicy and provocative conversations with the experts. Let's get down to it. Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another fabulous episode of the Sex Talk Cafe. I am so excited for my guest today. I have Dr. Diane Mueller, who is a board-certified sexologist with dual doctorates in naturopathic as well as acupuncture and oriental medicine. She's the founder of the sex education center called MyLibidoDoc.com and also hosts the Libido Lounge podcast, blending personal experiences with clinical expertise. Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe.
I'm so happy to be here. Hi, everybody. It's good to be with everybody today.
Yes. Well, I cannot wait for our conversation. I love your background, that you have a mix of experience. And I was reading a little bit up on you before we got on today, and I'm so curious to know a little bit more about your story, really coming out of the holistic realm, and then the emphasis now that you have on libido and working with couples. And can you just tell us a little bit about your story and kind of your background and how we find you today working with sex and intimacy?
Yeah, there's two main, I could give you like so many stories, but I think there's two main parts of my story that were probably the most influential in leading me down this path. And the first one was when I was in my early 20s and I started experiencing this pelvic pain. And this pelvic pain was of unknown origin. I had UTI tests, I had STI tests, and everything was negative, luckily, but it kind of just left me with this, well, what the heck is going on here? And so I was living with this wonderful roommate at the time who was very open about talking about her masturbation practice. I was raised in a way that was very not okay with not only talking about that, but due to religious, you know, things and influences, it was like, well, that's dirty. That's like not to be talked about. It's not to be touched. It's like, you know, just for the sanctity of marriage. So I had never considered something like masturbation. And she was just telling me, this roommate was just telling me about all the health benefits. And one day she gave me the book by Betty Dodson, Sex for One. So curious, you know, a curious 20-something year old me, I read this book and I'm lying awake at night in pelvic pain. And I decided to give it a go. I decided for the first time in my life to masturbate. And pelvic pain went away. It was like a miracle. And like the next day I'm lying in bed and it's back again. And the biggest thing that was happening with the pain, like not only was it painful, but it was keeping me up at night. So wow. Next day I'm in bed again and pain's back and I try it again and it works again. And so this happens a few times and all of a sudden after several sessions, the pelvic pain completely went away, never came back. So that was my first introduction to really reforming beliefs around pleasure and around what pleasure actually is and the health benefits for it and the point of pleasure. And I really, you know, reconstructed some of my religious beliefs, even from a religious standpoint around like, well, how could like God, spirit, energy, whatever anybody wants to call this kind of energy, how could I have this part of my body that is bad if we're like made in this image of spirit, of God, of all of this, right? So that was story one, number one, and really opened me up to just like curiosity around pleasure.
Wow. Well, there's a lot we could unpack in that. Let's pause here. Then we want to hear part two of the story.
Okay.
Let's talk about this because I think that we don't tend to think about pleasure as being this. Well, I know, you know, if you do, people like us who are geeks and study this stuff and teach it, like, yeah, we know, but our listeners might not know. We might have some listeners out there that maybe are experiencing pelvic pain. And what you're saying is from your experience, your pain went away and didn't come back. Let's talk about what's going on physiologically that could be related to in your experience and with your knowledge. Let's talk about that.
My suspicion is twofold on like the mechanism of what could be going on. One, anytime we are experiencing orgasm or heightened pleasure, when we're releasing things like oxytocin, when we're changing dopamine levels, we are actually seeing relaxing of the nervous system. We see that, like, some of our chemicals in our body, like adrenaline, like cortisol, which are our revved up kind of fight or flight chemicals. Oxytocin has the ability to balance those chemicals. It has the ability to get our nervous system into that more relaxed, calm state. It has the ability to balance cortisol, right? And so from a standpoint of a neurological dysfunction, like sometimes some pain is due to improper signaling of the nervous system, where the nervous system is basically triggered to release a chemical or to release a sensation that, say, the threshold changes, right? So for example, like if I knock my hand on my table right here, what's supposed to happen is, as it's very slight, I don't even register to my brain as anything other than like a tactile sensation. Mm-hmm. And so what can happen with the nervous system is it can become dysfunctional, where a little tap of my hand on my desk all of a sudden could actually, through neurology, trigger our brain to interpret that signal not as touch, but instead as pain.
Oh, wow.
And so anything that we're doing to kind of repattern the nervous system has potential capacity to re-regulate any sort of threshold like that. Mm-hmm. So mechanistically, that is one of my theories, is what was happening there. And then also, anytime that we are in pain like this, anywhere throughout the body, we also have to think about the functioning of the tissues, right? Yeah. Like, what is the muscle? How much are the muscles gripping and holding?
Right.
You know, it's like we think about things like, oh, those close calls in a car where it's like, oh, you almost get in an accident, you're like still like holding all that tension.
Right.
And so I think some of what could have been happening there as well was just like tension. And I have another theory that, from a standpoint of medicine and the spine, like one of the things we see in holistic medicine is this concept of as above, so below, meaning if I have something out of balance in my structure, like in my jaw or in my upper neck, then usually the body compensates by putting something out of balance in the pelvis, right? Mm-hmm. So it's almost like this compensatory type of thing. And so TMJ, for example, like where people hold all of this tension in their jaw, can theoretically actually throw the muscles and the pelvis off because they're trying to like accommodate for that dysfunction and try to even out the spine, even though it's dysfunctional. So I also have a theory that what can be happening in these situations is that, well, if there's tightness in the jaw leading to tightness in the pelvis, even if somebody doesn't have any known trauma in the pelvis, so many people hold tension in their jaw, that even going through that process of like contraction of the muscles through things like orgasm, that contraction, that relaxing, that proper functioning could be releasing some of the muscles that are potentially leading to that pain.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I would imagine also, if you've had a lot of religious programming, sex negative type of messages, which unfortunately that occurs a lot in the religious realms, but also socially, we can also just socially have encounters where, especially as women, we're shamed for being too sexual or being slut shamed, or that I think can also translate as tension or tightness in the pelvic floor and create some of that, lead to some of that pain. I also love the work. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Candace Pert. Do you know her work on the molecules of emotion? Oh, man.
No, I'm looking her up today.
Yeah, look her up today. She wrote a book called The Molecules of Emotion. Read it. Maybe we'll do a part two to this podcast. Because fabulous work on how our emotions actually release polypeptides into. So there's a physical component to all of our emotions. So, for example, sadness or anger or fear or anxiety, those actually release this very specific polypeptide that are in connection with the emotions that we're feeling, that then travel throughout the body and relay messages into the cells. And so, I mean, she proved that she's no longer living, but one of the things she says is that our body is the subconscious mind. And so when we are repressing our emotions, or we're having a lot of emotional content that's maybe not being fully processed through our nervous system, for example, that it can show up in the body as physical pain or numbness. And I think a lot of times when we have that disconnect from our sex center, or there's pain, even low libido, which we're going to get into that topic today, can sometimes even be a result of that, of these trapped emotions in the form of these polypeptides. Like, if there's a real physical scientific component, it's not just woo anymore. I mean, I love the woo too, but But like, I love that there's these real tangible ways of looking at this. So yeah, definitely look up her work. It's phenomenal and just like game changing to understand that.
I will. Yeah, it sounds almost similar to something like Biology of Belief or, you know, those kind of books as well.
Yeah, with Bruce Lipton. I know his work very well. Yes, with the exception that Candace goes into the more the physical component. I think Biology of Belief is more the energetic and how electromagnetics can heal. Yeah, super awesome. Well, so you work a lot with couples in your work, and I love that. I work with couples as well, and I think that I would love to dive into some of the challenges that you see couples face. And one of the most common ones that I know that I see as a sex therapist is this mismatched libido. Or we could even start with, maybe before we get to that topic, I mean, there's so many places we could go with this, but the decrease, what happens a lot of times, I'm sure you're familiar with this, is like things are great at the beginning, but then over time, where does that go? Where does the passion go? Where does the sex drive go? Let's just dive into that, because a lot of times that's kind of where couples are landing. Like, it works at the beginning, but then now they've been together a few years and suddenly they don't know how to get that spark back. So can you speak to that? I know this is the area of your expertise. I would love to get your perspective on this.
Yeah, absolutely. So the beginning, right, is that new relationship energy that so many of us talk about in the sex world. And that new relationship energy is where you're just basically high on the other person, right? You like can't stop thinking about them. Are they going to call? Are they going to text? And like, it's just that energy is so profound. And that energy is so profound for a couple different reasons. But one of the biggest ones is that everything is new. Everything is novel. And what newness and novelty create in the brain is a increase in dopamine. And that increase in dopamine is a huge part of desire. And what a lot of people don't understand about dopamine, so dopamine we think of as this motivation and this happy type of hormone. And it does do all that. But part of what also drives dopamine is that in-between space where we want something and we can't have it yet. Right? So that's part of that new relationship energy. It's like even thinking about, like, I like to compare things to chocolate cake for whatever reason. I don't eat that much chocolate cake, but I find myself comparing
chocolate cake.
I like it, but I don't eat that much of it. But maybe my dopamine is driving me to want more. So with something like, if you're thinking about, oh, a special treat, and you're going to have this dessert, or you're going to have this sugar, you're going to have a glass of wine with your friends, and you're thinking about it every day, like, I can't wait till Friday, or I can't wait till this. Every time you think that thought, you're actually increasing your dopamine, because that dopamine is motivating you towards that thing. So it's that space, right? And then it's that novelty of the unknown is the other part of the new relationship experience that really creates that dopamine. So now we get into a long-term relationship. And what happens oftentimes is we move in together, we make commitments, we oftentimes combine bills or expenses or kids or whatever it is. And now there's no space, right? So there's not that like space between like the longing. It's like, okay, see you at breakfast, see you at dinner, honey. So there's no space. So there's no time for that dopamine gap to really drive that motivation. And because of life, because of everything else, like, we are creatures of habits, right? It's like, how many times does somebody move to a new house and they wind up figuring out their route to work or the route they take a walk on? And we take the same walk every day. I just moved to a new place 9-10 months ago. And recently I took a different route on my morning walk, and I discovered this huge open space that I missed. And it's like a perfect example of, this is a quarter mile from my house and I walk almost daily, and I had never found this thing because I went on my habit of, this is my morning walk route. And so we do the same thing in our relationships, right? Where it's like we start to form these scripts of how we function day to day, how we function sexually. And we're just habit-making humans. We are. And so we start to go through these steps, these scripts over and over again. Well, then the novelty, the newness, the excitement, and the curiosity fall away. And when all those things fall away, so does that dopamine drive, so does that desire. And sadly, what leads to that oftentimes is boredom.
Yeah, that makes sense. So So what you're saying is in long-term relationships, well, the term habituation, I'm sure you're familiar with that, where we habituate, we just become used to each other. And even in sex, sexual satiety, where we're satiated, we have that feeling of fullness, okay, I'm going to roll over and go to bed. I know there's a lot of things chemically in the brain going on, even with that piece. But how then in a long, so if that's what happens, and I know you're a specialist in hot monogamy, like keeping monogamy hot over the long term. So what can a couple do if they have encountered this problem of boredom, or just getting into habit and routine?
And one, I do think it is important to begin to have conversations about this. Like some of the studies we see on improving sex, and sex meaning like penetration, non-penetration, just physical intimacy in many ways is what I mean by sex here. And what we see is that talking about it is actually one of the first things. Like I think the stat is 91% of couples that say they're happy with their sex life, really happy, talk about it. And so when we're not talking about it and actually together co-creating our experiences, co-exploring our fantasies,
right,
we're gonna get stuck in that rut. So there's strategies I have for talking about it, but one of the things that we do, and for a standpoint of novelty, as I look at novelty in many ways as like, I'm going to oversimplify this just to get people thinking about this, as people, places, and things. These are ways we can keep things novel. So for people in a monogamous relationship, this winds up being maybe role playing, right? So thinking about, okay, well, how can you role play different things? Maybe you're something cliche like the sexy, you know, secretary or whatever it is, right? Just like finding that ways to role play is one example of bringing people in a monogamous relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Places are as simple as like what you can think about around like, okay, well, if you always are intimate in the bedroom, maybe you're going to be intimate in the closet, maybe in the shower, maybe on the floor, right? I know a couple that has had so much great closet sex. It could just be after like hot place, right? And so we really want to think then about like, okay, where we're doing it, and even then in different positions, like having a, I love having sex position books by my bed. And it just can be a fun thing to just like flip through every once in a while, just get like inspired around like, huh, we've never tried that position, or like we've never.
What's one of your favorite? Tell me what one of your favorites is, because I've got a funny sex position story.
I'm totally a sucker for the pretzel. I just love the pretzel.
I think I know. I don't know that one. I'm gonna have to look that one up.
I just absolutely love it. I like that. I like reverse cowgirl a lot. Those are probably two of my classic things. But I think that's the other thing, right? Is like certain positions are not as good for certain vaginas.
That's so true. Right? Yeah. Like some of them are like, ah, like that just doesn't work for all bodies. I remember I tried one, this was like many years ago when I was married, called the wheelbarrow. And like legit, I was like, this sucks so bad. Like I'm like upside down, like in this handstand. My partner's behind me and I'm like, I am not relaxed. I'm not comfortable. I'm like, is this a cruel joke?
Done that one. It's like it's a terrible lot of energy, and all you're thinking about is like how tiring it is.
Exactly.
Focus on pleasure.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So, but you know, it's like those, that's the other thing too, I think, with like novelty and exploring all this is like, okay, like wheelbarrow, maybe not success, but it's also a really good sign in relationship when you can start trying these things. Yeah. And then just being okay and like laughing and giggling and being like, well, that was really funny. Like that didn't work out. And it can bring just like that novelty can bring so much like play. Like if we're like not so serious about it having to work and just more into like, let's just explore. Let's explore and have fun.
Sure. Like getting the curiosity back. But I know like at least in the couples that I work with, like a lot of them have had these really negative experiences. Like I call them train wrecks. Like things have happened intimately. It didn't go well. It goes south fast. And they are just like so anxious. They don't even want to have sex again. Yeah. They want to be because of that. And so like getting that level of curiosity back is, I mean, there's a real unlearning, I think, that has to happen. I'm just kind of curious what your take is on that. How do you get to that point where you can be more curious and laugh things off and have fun instead of it being so serious?
I definitely think it's a work in progress, right? It's not like this stuff is absolutely easy. And I think, you know, one of the other things that's super interesting is when we look at research on having these kind of conversations, the kind of conversations around sex and intimacy, there's three threats that people go through, that couples go through when they start to have these conversations. There's a threat to oneself, there's a threat to the partner, and there's a threat to relationships.
Mm.
And in most conflict conversations, research-wise, those get pretty equal weight. But when it comes to sex and intimacy, the biggest threat is the threat to oneself, by far,
sure.
is what studies show. And that's why I think it's so common for people to wind up shutting down or not hearing their partner, because there is this natural desire on conversations around intimacy to protect oneself.
Sure.
Right? And so yeah. that's the first thing to understand, I think, is that there's probably going to be a tendency of anybody's ego to do that. And one of the first places I love to start in, you know, in the couples I educate on this, is starting with just like what's going well and just starting to bring more conversation in of what you love and what's going well before you even try to fix anything. Like, even if it's as simple as like, okay, non-sexual stuff. Like, wow, I really love the way you walked by the other day. And you just brushed my arm, or you gave my hand a squeeze. And like that just is, you know, it just really made me soften. And starting to just bring those cues in for a while to start building people up. And that once we like feel like our ego is not threatened, it tends to be a lot safer to go into some of those conversations. And you know, and then even when it comes to like the physical intimacy and the sexual intimacy component of things, I should say, you know, same basic rules apply, like for many people around just starting with like, wow, I just love, you know, I love the way you kissed me the other night or whatever it is. And the more specific we can tend to be and the more we can really share like the level of the specifics of not only how like what they that partner did, but also what it provided for us.
Oh, yeah, I like that.
You know, it really can help encourage that behavior. And yeah, I do encourage people in my work to talk about the things that, okay, well, we don't like in bed. Like, if you, like, absolutely hate a position or something, like the wheelbarrow, like...
You'll never do that one again.
Right? But oftentimes when we start with the good, it's like that talking about the good and emphasizes those things, that some of those other things that you don't like, they might even just fall away because we're just bringing in so much more of what we
right.
love.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the most vulnerable things that we can do is ask for what we want. And, you know, there's a million reasons why we don't and all these things that we do instead. And, you know, what do you think, in your opinion, is the best time to have these conversations? Because I feel like there's times where you don't want to have these conversations. You don't want to talk about it. Bad timing. Yeah. And there's times where it's a little bit more suitable.
Yeah, I talk a lot about, like, the how, the when, the where of these kind of conversations. So... you know, from a standpoint of when, right, I do think it can be helpful to let our partner know. So if our partner's come home and we've had a bad day or our partner's had a bad day, it's probably not going to be the best time to bring up something that is already, like, tender to somebody's ego. Mm-hmm. So a conversation in advance around, like, and not the... honey, we need to talk, you know, kind of advance warning, because that's when right, warning bells like, no. up, right?
No, she right, wants to talk, help.
Exactly. Like, you know, saying something like, you know, babe, I really am, like, you know, wanting to improve our sex life, and you just did something the other day that I just absolutely loved, and I would just love to tell you about it and explore more things like that. When can we have a conversation like that? So if we say that, you're prepping them. So if they're just like not in the mood for something deep, or they've had a long day, you know, that they can process that and give you a time. But you're also softening it to be like, we're going to talk about good stuff in this thing. Like, this is not just like you're in trouble. So we can also like lower the warning bells and the nervous system there. Most of the time in the beginning, I tell people, like, your bedroom or wherever you've been physically intimate is not the place. Just from, if it doesn't go well, you don't want the next time you're in that room
right.
for those triggers to be there. Once it's like more an advanced skill and people get really good at this, then sometimes it's just like everybody's so comfortable that you can talk about it anytime. But in the beginning, it tends to not be the best time. Now, also with when, sometimes I've seen like the opposite side of things where then people are just like so waiting for the exact perfect moment and
right? It's never going to happen.
It's never going to be that exact perfect moment. So there is an element where you try to set yourself up for as success as possible, but also sometimes you just have to rip the Band-Aid off and go for it because, you know, that perfect moment of like everything being in alignment, you know, could take weeks, months, or years before you get there.
Yeah.
Like you're saying.
Never going to happen. Let's talk about low libido. So low libido in men versus low libido in women and the causes of that. There's physiological roots, and then there's also more psychological roots and things that have nothing to do with like a physiological cause. And I'm curious what you can share with our listeners about that and how is it different for men and women and how do we tell if it's due to something physiological or something more emotional or psychological?
Yeah, so I really break down the root causes into three major categories. So I do physical, personal, and interpersonal. So physical are more like the medical root causes.
Yeah.
Personal is going to be like, hey, do I know my body? Do I have things like numbness or pain? Am I holding? Do I have the ability to even enjoy pleasure and be in the moment? What's stopping me? So like my own personal kind of emotional things. And then the interpersonal, of course, is what is that relationship with this other person? Mm-hmm. And how are we jiving together? How are we communicating sexually and otherwise? So those are the three categories. Physically wise, I find that it's oftentimes hormones can be a huge role. Everybody knows that. But it's real common in my work that I see people driven to my work because they've already been on hormone replacement therapy.
Right.
And maybe it did even give them a boost. And it's like a common thing, if that's not the only problem, that it's like, oh, you get on some testosterone, for example, and you get a boost, the libido comes up and people are really excited. And then 3 or 4 weeks, it's like, actually, it all went away. And that's a huge warning sign to be like, this is not the only problem.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
So I do have, so if everybody goes to libidoquiz.com, I do have a cool online quiz that goes through and helps to identify like of the physical root causes. Is it most likely hormones? Is it circulation? Is it neurological? Is it pelvic pain? And then it'll give people like what tests to ask your doctor for, lifestyle changes. So that's a really cool quiz at libidoquiz.com for that.
Nice. Yeah, everybody go to libidoquiz.com and go take, I want to go take that quiz.
Yeah, that's really useful.
It is interesting because I think there tends to be this myth that the cure for low libido is just to take a pill. And I'll tell you, you know, I had a, when I first was starting out in my sex therapy practice, I had a client who came to me who I think she was 25. Quite young, and she had gone to her doctor because she just did not feel like having sex with her partner, and the doctor put her on testosterone at 25 years old, and saying what you just said happened, and it was great for 3 weeks, and then it just went back to how it was, and come to find out what the real problem was her partner was being really critical of her during sex. And I mean, who's going to want to open up sexually if they're being criticized or shamed? Yeah, so it's not just about take a pill unless you can. I mean, do you suggest that people do testing to determine? I guess you do. Like, let's see if it's the hormones, if that's even the root cause, not just like willy-nilly, let's put you on hormones, especially at age 25. Like, yeah.
Yeah, 100% test. And, you know, in 15 years of being a doctor, I have never seen a situation in my life that, unless we're talking about just like a common cold, I've never seen a thing that's, say, a more chronic recurring problem that only has one root cause, ever.
Yes, right.
So, you know, from that standpoint, it's like, well, if your testosterone's low and you tested for it, yeah, like balance your hormones, get on some replacement, do some supportive herbs. And at the same time, most of the time that for most people, it's not going to be just that.
Right.
And I think this whole thing, I mean, one of the things you bring up around this example around the partner being critical, I think this is like another societal cultural problem where some of that, and there's a lot of reasons for criticism, but some of the root cause of that, I think, comes from porn, from movies, from, you know, men and women both believing in many cases that women are supposed to be aroused, they're supposed to have a sexual response in the way that a man does.
Right.
And
right.
That's not how we work. And like,
exactly.
And so I think so many times that we get into these situations where it's so easy. And before I learned this work, I was super critical of myself because I wasn't having orgasms in 3 minutes like right. the movies. Like, you know, yeah. I was like, what is wrong with me? I thought there was something yes. actually wrong with me. And faking orgasms and all those things just to like please a partner because I yeah. thought there was something wrong. So I think so many times people get into these situations where it's like, well, if a woman's not responding that way, she can be critical of herself and a man can think there's something wrong with her sure. because everybody thinks it's supposed to work yeah. for women like men.
Right. And it doesn't. Right? We are wired differently. Yeah.
We are.
And that's just
why we have orgasms in 3 minutes most of the time.
Most of the time. It can't happen though.
It can.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that's just the lack of education. And, you know, there's a lot of even there's science and research out there in the medical that really reinforces this idea that women are dysfunctional because of that, because they have lack of orgasm or numbness in the clitoris, for example. And to put that out, oh, now you're dysfunctional. Like 50% of the women in this one study, it was Albert Einstein College and Yale University in 2005 did a study, and that was their conclusion. It was like 48% of the women in the study were sexually dysfunctional because of numbness in the clitoris and lack of orgasm. But that's not really dysfunction. That's just lack of education, most likely, right? But based on what you exactly just said, is our bodies are completely different. We need different things. And if we're given that and we know that that's what we need, we have different outcomes. So they should redo that study with an actual education on women's sexuality and see what they get then. It's my opinion.
That's so crazy. Like, if you look back at like Freud and when Freud was talking about like female sexuality, the belief he was promoting was that
so when women,
it's so bad. When women reach menstruation age, when they start to menstruate, they are supposed to then move their sensations from their clitoris to solely internally in their vagina. And he was giving out the diagnosis of frigid for anybody that could not orgasm from purely penetrative sex, and basically said the clitoris has, after the beginning of menstruation, the clitoris has zero function, no function. And zero purpose.
Idiot. But Freud is an idiot.
Totally.
Yeah, and he even said that the clitoris is some inferior penis. Look at it trying to be a penis. I'm like, man, you were really fixated on your dick, dude. Right. Like.
Yeah, it's really bad. And, you know, while I think like that level of thought is not, you know, say overt in our society, there's still covertness to it. It's still in our energy space around like if it's not penetrative vaginal sex that looks exactly this one way and like, you know, you're not coming in 3.2 minutes. Then there was something wrong.
Well, I mean, I remember when I was in high school, there was like this, you know, going around in the high school from the boys and the girls, you know, like, oh, men have better orgasms than women. And like legit, like as a, you know, young teenager, like you hear the other girls saying, oh, but men have better orgasms. Like, and I literally took that on as a belief until I one day had this epiphany of like, how the fuck would a guy know? Like, you don't have a vagina, bruh, you know? And it's usually actually not true because we can have multiples upon multiples, whereas most men, until they learn, I mean, men can do it too, but they have to really like learn how to do that. You know, like, no, you guys are like one and done. No wonder you're so obsessed with like the one orgasm. I mean,
right. Gotta be good because I'm not going to get another one later today or tomorrow.
Right. So, like, where did that lie come from? And God, thank goodness I had the wherewithal to have that epiphany at a very young age, probably while I was still in high school. But, like, there's some people I'm sure that lived on with that, you know, thinking, men have better orgasms than women. What a lie.
Yeah. I mean, I remember my grandma just, like, talking about growing up. She would say things like, you have to feed the dog. This was what she would say about sex. You have to feed the dog or he'll go to the neighbor. Like, that was, like, the programming around, like, the woman's sole responsibility was to make sure he was sexually satisfied, and if he cheated, it was probably her fault because she did not satisfy him. Like,
oh, man.
That's, like, not that long ago that was, you know, that was, I think, a pretty common belief.
Oh, well, there's that song, I think it's a Tom Waits song, if you don't get it at home, you're gonna go looking. Have you heard that?
I haven't listened to Tom Waits in many years.
I think it's Tom Waits. Yeah. If you don't get it at home, you're gonna go looking. Uh-huh. Yeah, so right. And like, that's so like socially acceptable in some way. We just expect that. Yeah, come on, women, you better be putting out. He's gonna go to the neighbors.
Right, it's gonna be your fault. Like, it's just it's crazy messaging.
Well, let's talk about the libido codes. What are the libido codes? Tell us what these things are.
So libido codes are really looking at our turn-ons and what turns us on. Mm. So when we're looking at, say, the three types of root causes of low libido, what I'm saying physical, personal, interpersonal, the libido codes kind of fit under personal slightly with interpersonal. So it's really looking to say, are we able to interpret our own signals? And then with a partner, are we able to interpret our partner's signals? So, for example, one of the libido codes is called the sensate. There's five different codes. One of them is called the sensate. And the sensate is the person that really is turned on by everything in the five senses. So what can happen? So this is the person that will take the time in the perfect, you know, the perfect scenario to set the music, to get the lighting right, to get the, you know, the proper smells. Maybe it's essential oil or making sure they go spray themselves with perfume or cologne. And it's a huge part of their intimate experience. And that will actually make a big difference for their sex drive, for being revved up. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting and important about the codes is, one, understanding your own so that you can turn yourself on more easily and access it. And we all have all of the codes within sure. us, I have found, but there's just tends to be one that's one or two that are more predominant. Mm. And with the partner, like in the sensate example, like one of the things I've seen with people, if they don't understand their partner as a sensate, so let's say there's two people, they start making out, and all of a sudden one partner gets up and they go turn on, they change the lighting, and they change, and like the partner that like got interrupted, they're like, what the heck? Like, you're ruining this moment. Like, we're here, I was with you, and then you're just like, all you care about is the music. It can be very disrupting. But when you start to understand your partner's code, one of the big things you start to understand is like, oh, this is actually worth it to take that 30 seconds or 60 seconds to do this, because that's going to help that person mm-hmm. be able to drop in so much deeper. Yep. So we start working together more on this as well. And I do have a quiz for this one as well, and that's super simple. It's libidocode.com.
Oh, that's fun. So you can figure out what your code is. Are you? Can you share what the other four codes are?
So the other one, we have the giver. So we did sensate. Mm-hmm. We have the giver. So this is the person that will tend to be most turned on by giving pleasure to mm-hmm. somebody else. So this is somebody that starts to give somebody a massage or starts to maybe just pleasure them, you know, through oral sex, something that's just like largely about the other person. Mm. And that's actually when they'll find themselves getting most turned on. So that's the giver. The kinky is the person that is most turned on by novelty, right? This is not fetish. So it's different than fetishes, which are, you know, more of our things that are just kind of like that little bit of obsession, right? Maybe it's a foot fetish, for example. Kink is really defined, like, for the audience as like novelty. So, and that's not outside of your norms. And so if your norms are missionary sex and you all of a sudden do a different position, that, and you're like turned on by it, it doesn't have to be blindfolds and handcuffs and BDSM. It could be, but it can be super simple. And so that person is going to be like, I think everybody has some level of these in them and need the novelty, but the kinky person is like, wow, this is the thing, right? And then we have the emotive. So the emotive is the person that is like, sex is so emotional for them. Mm. So this is the person that, like, you know, I interviewed actually a girlfriend recently, and she's an emotive, and she was giving an example of how she was, her partner asked her to stay in bed with her all day and just have like this in-bed play date. And they just had just something that was unresolved from last night. So from the night before. So she had to like get out of bed and physically like sit down and be like, we have to like emotionally resolve this before we go on. And just knowing that, right? So that's the emotive. Mm-hmm. And then we have the playful. And the playful is like the most turned on by the tease. So this is the person where it's like sending the dirty, you know, the dirty texts or the flirty pictures and all those things. Having a date night on Friday and teasing about it and talking about it all week long. That's what's going to rev them up the most. So if that's skipped, it can be very, very hard for them to drop in.
Yeah. Cool. Oh, I love this. This is so fun.
Yeah, it is. All these archetype models are always so fun to explore and to learn and to just be able to have different language.
Yeah, because I think there's sure, are different models out there, but I like the way that you approach it, call it the codes. And I think, right, like knowing what your preferences are, like just even in different types of touch, a lot of times you don't even realize what's even available, like what's even on the menu. We just sort of go straight for genital touch, for example, whereas, you know, some people aren't immediately aroused by going straight to the genitals. It's more like what you said, the playful, having teasing and more spaciousness. I love too, just to kind of circle back, is this whole idea of having space and distance is the thing that creates the well, not novelty necessarily, but it's, novelty creates the dopamine, and so that space and distance also is a dopamine feeder. And what we do is we tend to forget that, right? We tend to forget that we need some space and distance to be built in to a long-term relationship in order to kind of keep, just on that physiological level, like that's one of the things that keeps that spark alive, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not only time together and like that space. Oftentimes, we, you know, people live together and move in, but it's so common, right, that throughout the day we are talking to our, you know, our intimate partner, and it's like there's texts and there's phone calls and all that, and there's beauty in that, right? It's like there's definitely like safety and security. I'm not saying like don't do that, but I am saying that we have to have some ways of creating that longing. And, you know, one way that we can create that is actually, this is where a lot of us need to talk about scheduling sex. But scheduling sex isn't just about like prioritizing it and bringing it back in. Scheduling sex is actually creating that longing. And so, for example, if we schedule a date where we're saying, okay, we're gonna have sex date night on Friday at 7:00. Well, the way that we make it like more desire driven is we bring back the flirt into it. And so, you know, we start thinking on Monday, like, what would be like a fun, cute outfit? And maybe we text our partner about what panties we're going to wear. Like, you know, just like starting small, like, oh, I'm really excited about this. And like, I just want you to grab me here, grab me that way. And all of these things that we can start to play with during the week. And so we can create space then by saying, oh, I can't wait for you to grab my butt on Friday, right? Or I can't wait to be, you know, for like any of that. And then that sort of thing creates that longing around like, okay, like
expectation, you know, and anticipation, correct, which is the dopamine, really how dopamine works. That's my understanding of it. It's really the, like you were saying earlier, the anticipatory hormone. Like for example, with gambling, I think that's one of the reasons people can get so addicted to gambling, because you're like so excited, and then the thing happens and then you win or you don't, and so, but you want more of that dopamine, and then as soon as you get the thing with dopamine, you get that massive letdown of dopamine, and then it's like, okay, I think even there can be sometimes some sort of like low, you get kind of a low after a big dopamine hit. Can you speak to that, like sexually and just relationally? Are you, you know, how could that potentially show up in a relationship if we're building, and then you get the thing? Can it sometimes have an opposite effect where we feel then maybe disconnected or more sadness than happiness and joy from the dopamine?
Typically what I've seen, because of the way oxytocin balances dopamine and serotonin in the body, and we get so much oxytocin from anything from orgasm to just physical touch, but it is prolonged physical touch, right? A lot of people know about like 20-second hug. What a lot of people I find don't know about is like to get oxytocin released from a kiss, it has to last at least 6 seconds.
Oh, wow. And, no kidding.
Right. So it's like we think about, oh, you know, that quick peck from our partner, like, okay, oh, love you, honey. Have a good day at work. Mwah. Like no oxytocin basically from that. Like, you know, or minuscule at best. And so from the standpoint of dopamine, I haven't seen any research saying like, hey, there's any like negative refractory period after intimacy. If anything, it's just more balancing, because oxytocin is so promoting of dopamine and so promoting of serotonin. And so I think because of that oxytocin that we get, that is one of the things that makes it, say, more balanced act versus gambling.
Yeah, it can mediate the dopamine. And I think when oxytocin is released in the presence of another, it has actually a different impact on the body than if it's just released without another human there. It's like literally the bonding hormone. And I understand that as well, that it can help to mediate some of the dopamine letdown. But here's another book for you.
Yeah.
Read it, and then we'll do a part two. Cupid's Poisoned Arrow. I can't remember the name of the author, but that's a fascinating book. I'd be so curious to see what your take is on it, because she does all this research and study on the different chemicals that are released in the brain at the point of climax. So we're talking about your standard 4-stage orgasm, which I call climax, right? Because we know there's so many more types of orgasm available to us than just the one. But sort of where you're aiming, and we get goal-oriented around that kind of climax. But anyway, she talks about the letdown of the different chemicals in the brain, including, you know, dopamine, oxytocin, prolactin. But it's a really interesting perspective on it. And she has this theory that because of the massive letdown of the dopamine, that it actually can lead, without enough balancing of oxytocin. So there's ways to mediate it, like skin-to-skin contact, making more eye contact, but that without that, that it can actually lead to more feelings of irritability and disconnection and sometimes sort of mild depression feelings. It's all very subtle, but it's a really interesting read. And I did an experiment on myself many, many years ago when I very first read that book. And I would say I found some of that actually to be true for me, for my body at that time. No, I haven't like tested it out again, but definitely check it out and let me know your thoughts on it. It'd be a really good
conversation. I'm going to make a whole list of cool points we can talk about as I'm reading it.
Awesome.
Great.
Well, Diane, is there anything that we did not touch on today that you think is important for our listeners to hear on this topic?
Now, one of the things I've been thinking about in general is this definition of pleasure, right? Mm. Because I think pleasure, sometimes it's thought of like hedonic, right? And thought of as selfish. And this morning on my walk, I was actually thinking about this and really defining it in at least my morning visualization is that pleasure is the capacity to enjoy life.
And I love that.
Really what I think I'm going with in my current definition right now is because when we look at pleasure, right, and like we look at what happens from enjoying life, from enjoying what we're doing, you know, with whatever we're doing at work, what we're doing with our kids, enjoying our drive, enjoying all these things. These are the things like that capacity to experience enjoyment, the capacity to experience pleasure is directly related to happiness, to health, to well-being, to connection, to sleep. So, so many different things. So I think it's important to kind of broaden pleasure from just outside the bedroom and really like we're talking about truly our ability to enjoy each and every moment of life. And of course, there's always hard times, right? I'm not going to sugarcoat this and be like, you know, and be like, well, yeah, life is just like always awesome. Like, no, there's always hard moments, of course, that's human existence. But the more we can cultivate a practice, a pleasure practice, the more that we can cultivate the practice of intentionally showing up to enjoy as much as possible, I just think it has the capacity to move mounds personally in how people show up in their own lives, as well as how they show up to the people they love.
Yeah, I love that because I do sometimes see how the word pleasure can sometimes not even be an accurate description of what we're aiming for in some circumstances, like with a self-masturbation practice or a mindful erotic practice, what I might call self-pleasure practice. But I got away from that for that reason, because sometimes with some clients I've worked with, the whole idea of touching themselves is not pleasurable at all. They're like, this sucks. I feel weird. I have a lot of shame. Am I even doing it right? This is not even, doesn't even feel like anything. So yeah, kind of reframing this idea of pleasure as enjoyment, the capacity to experience enjoyment. And I think along with that comes the ability and the capacity to receive deeply, that receiving is really like a fundamental core aspect of that ability to enjoy, and expanding our capacity for enjoyment in life in general is our ability to actually receive and to feel more deeply in our bodies.
Exactly. Yeah. Very, very well said.
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, great. How can our listeners find you? And that you gave those awesome quizzes, which I hope people will go check out. I want to go check them out. Those sound great. Maybe you could just share those again for our listeners. And then any other offerings or events, how can people find you? Anything you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Yeah, thank you. So again, the quizzes are the libido quiz at libidoquiz.com to find the root causes of low libido from a physical perspective, give you labs, like lab ideas, things to take to your doctor, that sort of thing. And then the libido code at libidocode.com to find your unique code of your turn-ons, your turn-offs, to help both you and your partner support you in getting you in the mood and reading your partner's signals. And then my signature product is my Libido Club. And Libido Club is a monthly membership where people can come in and learn anything from how to talk to your partner about sex, how to bring more novelty back in monogamy, how to try new techniques, what to do if you have pelvic pain, erectile dysfunction, all these things, tools and tips for healing on that, plus live calls with me, or you can come on and ask me questions directly yourself. So you can find all of that just by going to my website at mylibidodoc.com.
Awesome. MyLibidoDoc.com. And of course, I'll put all these links in the show notes. And Dr. Diane Mueller, thank you so much for being my guest today on the Sex Talk Cafe.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you for joining me for the Sex Talk Cafe. Please be sure to leave a 5-star review, subscribe, and share this podcast with your friends. And if you're ready to discover the 3 secrets to deepening connection, enhancing pleasure, and expanding your orgasmic potential, then be sure to grab your copy of the Pleasure Keys ebook at pleasurekeys.com. To learn more about my private coaching, couples retreats, and other offerings, be sure to connect with me at pathwaytopleasure.com or find me on social media at Susan Morgan Taylor. Thank you again so much for joining me today for the Sex Talk Cafe.